Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on today's episode, Brexit is getting messier and more expensive as the process moves forward. A chilling note found in a purse at a Walmart. Pretty interesting. We'll take a look at that. Also, Ben Carson wants to make housing available, just not too comfy, according to the headline. And President Trump, he has a new controversy, and it has to do with the Civil War. We'll take a look at that in our history segment. That and more this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter if you'd like to, at kpcgfm, and also email us comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. And we're experiencing a pretty chilly day here in Oklahoma for May. And I'm probably not even going to crack 60 today. This is like Canadian and Wisconsin weather, so it's been pretty chilly, and we've had some rain a little bit on and off throughout the day, and we have a rain gauge that's just outside the studio here. I don't know if you guys have noticed it, but the birds would go and sit on it, and so it was causing problems with our rain gauge. So now there's a fake owl that's been installed, and I'm actually afraid of it because its head turns.
Wow.
Yeah, you take a look at it when you go outside. We'll have to tweet a picture of it later. But I'm scared. It's supposed to scare the birds. It's scaring me.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's there to, if it's there just for the birds. So.
It's going to scare everybody away.
Yeah.
It looks pretty real. I thought it looked pretty real yesterday, and then this morning its head was moving. So it like rotates its head. So anyway, we'll have an accurate rain count,
yeah.
I guess, if whoever's brave enough to go over there and take a look at it. So anyway, kind of interesting weather going on here in the States. A lot to talk about in today's program, including this story. This comes from the new issue of Fortune magazine. I don't know why I get a subscription to that because I don't have a fortune. Maybe I'm trying to build a fortune. But they have some interesting notes in here, and one of them is talking about the just the job market in the United States. And there's always this thought that automation is going to take more jobs, and of course probably is taking some jobs. And one of the jobs that they think it's going to start to take is long-haul trucking. I'm not sure how comfortable I am with that. I don't know that I want to see robotic trucks driving around, but they say this is the wave of the future. They say when Americans talk about robots taking our jobs, they're usually referring to factory work, and that's because we don't have self-driving trucks yet. Truck driving is one of the occupations most vulnerable to automation and one of the most common. In Omaha, 2.8% of people who have jobs are truckers. In Joplin, Missouri, it's 5.6%. The threat of losing those jobs over the next decade is real, they say. Last fall, a truck full of beer in Colorado made the first full automated delivery. So, of course, it'd be a truck full of beer to make the first automated delivery. But apparently, this is the wave of the future, they're saying. And a lot of people do drive truck. You can make a decent living. It's a hard job, but that would affect the economy.
That's always been one of my dream jobs, to be able to go trucking, because you're not tied down to any one location, and you can pretty much see the whole country. So it would be a shame for every one of those guys. I'm sure they enjoy that type of work.
I think it's one of those jobs you have to really... You really have to enjoy it, or else, you know, it's like anything. It could be real frustrating, but some people love it. They love getting out there and driving. And some areas of the country are pretty tricky. If you've ever been through more mountainous areas and you see like those runaway truck ramps, that's pretty, you have to know what you're doing when you're hauling those big rigs and those big loads and you're going down hills and up hills, and then you get somebody in a little car cutting you off and slowing down. So I do respect the knowledge that it takes to drive those things.
Yeah, well, it's definitely needed. I mean, I think every time we go to Walmart or those big stores, there's always trucks coming in and out, getting everything they need. And there's one close family friend. He used to drive truck, and he had some really amazing experiences. Some of them are pretty near brushes with death, I guess. Just in the States, you're suddenly in the middle of like a car chase on the interstate when you're driving your truck, and the police are all around you, and because the other guys just pass you. And then the one man I know, he was driving truck at Fort McMurray when that fire swept through.
Oh yeah,
and he was stuck right in the middle of it, and he was carrying wood chips.
Oh no,
but he got through okay. But you just never know what you're gonna see when you're driving truck, I guess.
Yeah, I don't like to be next to trucks at all, but particularly ones that are carrying flammable substances. I'm like, that's a bomb on wheels right there. The only thing I've ever seen involving a truck was years ago on the interstate. It was a little ways ahead, but one of the tires blew off of it and it shot straight up in the air. It must have been like 50 feet, it felt like, anyway. It just shredded. The tire just shot straight up. Oh. So they've got, you know, several tires on there, so I think he was all right, but still. A lot happened in there with trucking. So anyway, there's a chance that those jobs are going to become more automated, and we'll see how that goes. I still don't trust that technology, but... we'll see. Aren't they called trains?
Right.
Automated trucks.
You need a track for something like that.
Yeah, if they're on a track, I'd feel a little more comfortable. By the way, let me ask you guys. We've got a train track not too far from here. And they built this huge thing next to it. You know what I'm talking about? That,
yeah.
Like, cylinder. Anybody know what that is?
No clue.
I drive that by there once a week, and some people, one elderly man that Grant and I, we help take care of. Every time we drive past it, he's always wondering what it is.
Yeah.
And I even researched on the internet, I couldn't find anything.
Yeah, I'm very confused about what it is.
That's cause for great concern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have two theories, though.
Spaceship?
Nuclear silo?
Yeah. My first theory is a nuclear silo, actually. And then for a cruise missile. And the third one, or the second one, is just, I know, some kind of grain silo.
Grain, yeah. Yeah. It looks like it. It's a big, for the listeners that don't know what we're talking about, which would be most everyone, it's a huge, like, cylinder, and then it's got sort of this like base on it that's kind of opens up then to looks like you could fill it up with something. I'm not sure, but there's no, I can't see any spout coming out of it or anything that would lead me to think that it would fill up a train, but I just don't know what it is. It's a huge thing, and I think that's the great local mystery. Everyone's like, what is that? Every time we drive by, that's the same conversation we have, too.
Yeah, and it's weird because it was just a normal silo for a long time. Then they started building this thing around it, bigger one. And it doesn't have a top on it. It's just open, so it catches everything in it. Maybe it's supposed to catch water, like rainwater.
I don't know. I feel bad for the people that live within eyeshot of it, because you had a decent view of the whatever landscape. Also, there's this huge concrete structure sitting there. So anyway, kind of interesting what you see when you drive around sometimes. As far as jobs go, they talk about some of the industries that need more and more training because the skills keep changing. That's probably every job, but here are some that need the most. Media and entertainment, 27% feel like they have to keep changing their skills. Which makes sense. You know, YouTube was not heard of a few years ago. Now, if you don't know about YouTube, forget about it. I mean, things keep changing. Healthcare, of course, changes. I'm kind of surprised on that in some ways. I guess new technology. But energy sector. And then the one with the most change, they say, and this is strange to me, but finance. 43% of people working in finance say they need to update their skills. I'm not sure, you know, math's math, right? But maybe there's... there's more to it than I know.
Maybe they're going digital. Maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah, it could be. Or just different ways of doing it.
Yeah, I guess maybe each new administration in the U.S., they change the way they do things, different rules, different laws, different ways of getting mortgages and all that stuff. So maybe by skills, they mean understanding, like, tax codes and all that kind of stuff.
Probably
but
so.
But then, as Grant said too, like, understanding the latest software to do it all.
Yeah, it's a tough job if you're in finance because the government regulations always change. And so you've got to deal with healthcare and you've got to deal with all these other things. So that's always changing, I guess. One of the big stories going on globally is the Brexit. This is a write-up from the International Business Times. EU will demand up to £100 billion, or sorry, euros, got to get my symbols right there, for UK divorce bill as it plays hardball on Brexit. They say Brussels will slap a hefty price tag on Britain's Brexit bill by demanding an upfront gross payment of up to €100 billion, £84 billion. And that's the new report. The Financial Times has analyzed stricter demands made by France and Germany, and come up with a figure after taking into account farm subsidies and EU administration fees in 2019 and 2020. It's never easy to break up. They want their cash, and I think if people unfortunately have been through that personally, some sort of a split up there, it's a lot of money involved. Now we're talking about nations and big economies, and so they want €100 billion. Sorry.
That says a lot about the entire construction of the European Union, how it's not really true freedom because they're doing so much to lock all the nations in that even if the people vote and they choose to leave, it's almost like, okay, you can leave, but it's really going to cost you. We're going to make it as complicated as possible.
Yeah, they're not. It's not a pleasant parting of company. They're trying to make it as difficult as possible. And, boy, that tells you that going forward, that's going to be a bad relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, headlines like this, I saw another one where they think Welsh farming will disappear because of Brexit. It just, I think, to me, emphasizes how dangerous the European Union can be in the sense that once you get tied into it, it you either do what it says or it destroys your economy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we've seen that with Greece and other nations as well. But for the UK, which is still one of the top five economies in the world, if I'm not mistaken, it's up there anyway. It's still one of the most powerful ones, top financier in Europe for the time being anyway. If you get in entangled with them, they can pretty much do whatever they want and you have to pay the bill. One guy I saw, he said that the reason the Financial Times or International Business Times, the reason they rolled out that headline is because they want Theresa May to have a majority of 200 seats. So, because it is a more conservative-leaning paper, so they could have... They're doing that to try to get people to support her because she's being pretty tough in Brexit talks. So, but I won't be surprised if it is that much because we're talking about years and then the EU trying to get everything out of a good UK economy.
Well, and isn't it a threat to other nations? Yeah, if you want to leave, this is what happens. To me, that's kind of a setting the just the precedent for what other nations would expect. If it was easy and no problem, then other people would think more about it, I think other countries. But if it's a really tough deal, then others would not be as quick to leave, I guess. I wonder if that was in the sales pitch when they tried to get the EU going. Like, hey, come on, join. If you leave, we'll probably destroy you. Or try to.
Probably. It does seem like there was a lot of a lack of knowledge there for a lot of the countries that got in. They didn't really understand all of the implications of what they were getting into, or maybe some countries felt desperate like they had to get in. But it's never like any of those countries really got in there out of a position of strength.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you get into a situation, whether it's personal or nationally, and you don't know all the details of what happens if you pull out or if something, you know, goes wrong. That's not fun to find out. Here's another headline. This is also from the International Business Times. This is really interesting. Desperate note from Chinese sweatshop slave found in purse bought in Walmart. Crystal Wallace says she discovered the handwritten plea in the zip compartment of a purse she bought from a Sierra Vista Walmart 2 months ago. So she buys this purse from Walmart, and as we all know, a lot of products that come from China, at least they always say they're made in sweatshops. You know, they're not paying the employees much. It doesn't cost much to make them, and then you got to pay a lot over here, which is amazing. The markup on some of that stuff, really all of it, it's insane.
Yeah.
I saw something about Nike tennis shoes. What the markup is? It's craziness. I think when the stores buy them, they get them for like $20 a pair or something. Then they try to sell them for 80 or 90.
Right.
You know, and that and if they're buying them for 20, and Nike's still making money. What did they cost to make them? 10 cents? You know, I don't know. But anyway, so obviously I think we all know that there's some great practices over there as far as labor goes. So they find this note in the purse, and the daughter-in-law had the note translated by three different Chinese speakers, and each of them deciphered a similar harrowing message. They have a picture of it, and it's in whatever the language is, some sort of Chinese dialect. So they had to translate it. I mean, whether or not it's real or not, I guess, would be debatable, but it'd be quite an elaborate hoax. You'd have to know how to write in whatever the Chinese language was.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I think it does draw attention to an important issue, and that's how much of the American textile industry is made by 10-year-olds in Asia. And it's a thing, a pretty significant amount, and it also kind of, with the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that Trump pulled out of, there was a lot of the whole idea behind it was to regulate this sort of thing, start to get rid of these conditions. But the only reason the deal could be signed is these nations said, no, we're going to regulate it ourselves. So basically they're going to keep the sweatshop conditions in their countries because right. it brings in money to them too. So unfortunately it's just a huge problem, and no one government is really advocating change or can be a champion for these people in those conditions.
They have a full translation of the letter provided by the Huffington Post. This is what the letter reads. Again, it was found in a purse at Walmart that was bought from Walmart. And they wrote this. Inmates in the Yingxiang prison in Guangxi, China, if I got that right, are working 14 hours daily with no break or rest at noon, continue working overtime until 12 midnight, and whoever doesn't finish their work will be beaten. Their meals are without oil and salt. Every month, the boss pays the inmate 2,000 won, about $290. Any additional dishes will be finished by the police. If the inmates are sick and need medicine, the cost will be deducted from the salary. Being a prisoner in China is even worse than being a horse, cow, sheep, pig, or dog in the U.S. That's the end of their letter. So, interesting.
Yeah, it's. Hopefully they can figure out a way to verify it, because I would be really condemning if that is a real account. But, I mean, I think there's enough evidence out there that this kind of activity does go on in certain parts of China. And that maybe not in the same way that that person described, but there is plenty of evidence to suggest that there are human rights abuses in that nation. And so it is an ongoing issue. And I think maybe it's something we should all think about before we buy clothes from different, but I mean, there's nothing you can do about it, but it's still maybe good to think about.
Yeah, anything you buy that's made in the U.S. is always more expensive, typically because they have to pay somebody to more money to make it. So it is sort of interesting there. And you can just imagine the trouble they would get into if they got caught writing that and putting it in there. They need to check their quality control. Who's checking these purses?
That's a good point. Yeah, it's also disturbing too, because about with Chinese prisons and a lot of places where there's a somewhat totalitarian rule, those are not just hardened criminals who are in prison. It's also any journalist who dares to speak out against the regime in charge, anything like that, where the people in power think that person's a threat, they can be put in prison too. It's not just you actually committed a crime. So these are, even some innocent people are suffering those types of conditions too.
Yeah, really, really an interesting write-up from the International Business Times there. And I don't know what I would, if I bought something and I found a note in it like that, I'd probably just throw it in the garbage. Be like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
So good on them for getting it translated. I've mentioned this before, but there's a mall out there in California, right near Palm Springs, out a little ways from Palm Springs, big outlet mall, and it's close to the airport there. And so there's a lot of airport customers that come through, and there's so many people from China that shop there that a lot of the tags are in Chinese, some sort of dialect, which was interesting. You go and you look at the tag on the clothing, and it's in Chinese, whatever the language is, and then it's in U.S. because most of their clientele are these people traveling through. And so if I had gotten something from there, I guess I wouldn't have thought too much of it. I'd be like, well, I don't know, it's just the price tag, I guess. But in this case, it was an actual handwritten note, apparently, if it wasn't a fake, from somebody there in a prison in China.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I lived in Calgary, along one of the main roads, there's about four or five malls as you go down on each side of the road. And one of them is an Asian market. And I never really went in there, but my sister and I went in there one day, and there is no English anywhere. Hmm. It's all in, I think, three different Asian languages, like probably Chinese, Japanese, and looks like something from Thailand. Yeah, there's no English in there. So when we were walking around, we didn't know what anything was. The people speak English, the shop right. owners. But yeah, I just was really surprised. I never knew that there was a place like that right in the middle of this huge city in Canada.
That mall out in California there, don't go to the Starbucks. Let me just tell you from experience. You get in line behind, like, you know, 30 Chinese people, and they don't speak English, and the barista doesn't speak Chinese.
Oh, no.
Or very good English. And it's a long, long time. And I noticed that they don't like to stand in line the way I want to. Like, I want the line to move, and they seem to be happy to just kind of let the line in front go and then eventually meander up there. So culture clash at Starbucks. We had different ways of going about things. And trying to order, like, a venti caramel frappuccino when you can't even speak the languages. That's going to take you a time. That's some pointing. That's a lot of pointing going on.
Yeah.
So do you think in that type of situation that maybe the Chinese should just say, they should learn the word drink and then just be happy with whatever's handed back at least?
I don't know.
Because it is a pretty big hassle there. That's tough. And that's the same if we go somewhere and they don't speak English as well. You know, we can really start holding some things up.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think if you could, I don't know, they probably don't pay a whole lot to work the barista there, but if you could speak both languages, boy, you'd be valuable.
Oh, yeah.
I think Starbucks should make an international charades language. To no matter where Starbucks you're in, if you act out a certain drink, then that's what you get.
Or
it's barrier free.
Or you could hire people to stand in, like, human costumes of the drink.
Yeah,
yeah.
And people could just go up and hug the one that they want, and you know that's the beverage of their
element
choice.
Element of love added to it as well.
Yeah, and it would help everybody get along and add some jobs. It would really solve two things at one time. make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show coming up here in a bit on KPCG. That's going to be here at noon today, and you can catch the replay at a few different times as well. Archives are online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. And check out the headlines from thetrumpet.com today. The featured story is This Week in Germany, Muslims in Germany, Nazis in the Army, and Merkel in Russia. That's a little video there by Richard Palmer, so you can check out that and see the headlines from Germany this week. Related to that, was this Germany's 9/11? That was from January the 4th. And will Europe rediscover its Christian identity? Those are the top stories there at thetrumpet.com today. Check it out. This is Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Grant, you've got an interesting article for us from the New York Times. Ben Carson, I think people remember him from the campaign. Ben Carson wants to make housing available. He just doesn't want it to be too comfortable.
Yeah, so obviously you can tell the tone of the story even before we start talking about it. But Ben Carson is the Housing and Urban Development Secretary under Mr. Trump in the Trump administration. And he was going on a tour of some affordable housing complexes in Ohio. And so this is kind of just an account of what was going on. And, of course, he thinks that, and he grew up in this situation in Detroit. He thinks that to get out of poverty, people should not be set up in this comfortable, cushy environment, or else there's no incentive to move up the ladder.
You're right. So his point is, give people the help they need, but don't make it too comfortable to where they just want to rely on that, and they don't have some sort of motivation to get out there and improve their situation.
Exactly. And you know, there were some comments that he made where this article, I think, tries to smear him a little bit, but he said something like, one of the apartment complexes lacked only pool tables, so it was so well equipped. It's like, why would people ever leave a place like that? You know, if you have a large screen TV in the living room of your affordable housing apartment, then how come anyone would ever decide to leave?
Yeah, it is interesting. You do want to see people have a safety net if there's some problems. But, like he says, you don't want it to be something to where it's just too comfortable to where you never want to improve. It's supposed to be a temporary help, and then people hopefully can get kind of on their feet and get going. And one of the great motivators in life, I think, is I don't know if you want to call it fear, but maybe fear, to where, hey, I want to improve so I can have a better life, mm-hmm. you know. And if there's no incentive to do that, I think we all tend to kind of just take it easy and not really do the best that we can.
Exactly. There does have to be an incentive to move up. Being in such an ideal location or setting, or having it, you know, just perfect down at the very bottom, it really would not provide much reason to try and build up and eventually get a mansion one day. You know, it wouldn't really motivate you too much. And a lot of these things, like Mr. Carson brought out, are able-bodied people. That we're not just talking about those who are handicapped or have a mental illness. We're talking about people who are totally able-bodied and young and could work, and yet they're taking advantage of things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're also trying to sort of cut some of these things from the budget, some of these welfare programs that do seem to stifle a lot of work ethic.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see some of the numbers on that, because we were talking just even the other day about how, you know, people do kind of count on a welfare system in case they need help. But in some nations, you don't have that. I mean, you know, you got to make it on your own the best you can. And so you don't want to be in a situation where it's things are just handed out and you don't have to move forward. So they are trying to cut some things from the budget. Any other initiatives that they're trying to take to maybe get it more in line with what this current administration's thinking?
Well, what he's done is he's actually traveled to several locations. I believe Miami was another one of them. And he went to a few other places around the country just to try to observe firsthand what some of these housing complexes were like. That way he could sort of understand what he was dealing with. And obviously with a lot of them, he was surprised at how nice they were, because, you know, obviously that's going to take away from the budget. The federal government's going to be subsidizing a lot of those different developments. And so there are obviously a lot of ways to cut back on that if you remove some of the TVs or things like that. There were some people quoted in this article who didn't really like Mr. Carson coming through. They thought it was like a staged photo opportunity and weren't too pleased with that. One of them said, if he got something to do with Trump, that means he's not really for us. It's not surprising. That's what the rich do. They make it hard for the poor. That a kind of a quote like that makes you wonder why so many people think that way, like the rich just hate poor people. You hear it in every election that the rich need to pay their fair share, or that the rich just are not doing enough to support these different programs when they're paying millions and we're not. So in reality, if everyone paid the same percentage, the rich would still be paying far more than everybody else. And that's not really the way it's looked at. It's looked at like rich people are the cause of the poor people's problems. Who is putting out that message? I think that's a lot of the media's influence. Otherwise, people could look at it and say, oh, well, the rich are providing us these jobs. They're the ones paying our salary and making us it possible for us to live too.
Yeah, it's interesting. What I think would be really good for anybody, we all need like a clear path of improvement. Like, how do we improve? And I don't know, you know, exactly what's being offered in some of these different situations, but in some cases you have generations of poverty and it's hard to get out of it. It's hard to see a path out of it. And so hopefully that's clear. Like, hopefully they can see a clear path and maybe spend more time following that if it's available. And I think that it is. I think there's plenty of programs out there where you can try to get on your feet and try to improve and try to get going. And, you know, it takes patience and it takes time. I mean, nobody starts out at the top usually, you know, but you can work your way up in most cases. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, no matter what the job is, if you work hard, you apply yourself, you can usually work your way up and improve your situation. And so sometimes people do pretty well financially and they go back to, say, a community like, you know, some of these communities, and they do try to help in certain ways. But there's just too many that just don't. Either they don't see the path of getting out, or they don't think it's, you know, they can get there, or aren't interested, or something's happening, because it is a systematic problem where you just keep seeing poverty exist, even in the richest of nations like the U.S.
Yeah, it really is a big problem, and obviously there's a lot of division about the way to go about solving that. There are some issues where people would say the family unit needs to be strengthened to help with that, because economically speaking, two-parent households end up producing the most income. But also there's other people who think that if we give out more money to these people, it will help them get up. That's where it becomes a difficult question, because if you put yourself in the shoes of the poor person, if people are going to be handing you money, would you just be content to stay where you are, or would you really want to go about toiling to get up higher on the ladder?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a tough situation.
It is. There's no good solutions. That's always a hard thing when you come in as a leader of any kind, is that there are major problems and you have to try to find solutions. And really the solutions are things people don't want to hear for the most part, because it means changing some things you're doing, changing the way you're living. And it's not the comfortable solution. It's much easier to say it's somebody else's fault.
Right.
And we need to make the wrong right. But in almost every case, no matter what the other circumstances are, we all have a big personal part in our situation.
Yeah, and that's a big thing today that doesn't seem to be emphasized very much, is the factor of personal responsibility in people's situations. It's not just that people have no control. We're not in a nation where the government is stomping on us. It's not like that in any way. There are ways to become successful, but if you look at what the media is saying, you would think that some people just have no chance whatsoever. Mr. Carson's actually on a mission to cut his department's budget by 13%, so you can understand why he might be a little bit suspicious of some of these developments that are really highly developed, that you can't even really tell apart from some regular housing areas.
Yeah, and unfortunately, anytime there's funds given to good causes or to try to help people, a lot of times there's a little bit of misuse. I don't know in every case, but it seems like there's, I mean, even the new budget that has been proposed, I forget how much that's for, but there's all this stuff in there where you're like, what, really? We need this and that and the other. So even when funds are allocated, you know, sometimes they don't track where they're going that well.
Yeah, and if you look at what we're dealing with the national budget, always what comes up is that we need to cut military spending, even though that's the defense of the nation at stake, because politicians don't want to cut the welfare state out, because that's going to lose a lot of votes. That's going to be highly unpopular for a lot of people who have grown accustomed to the support.
So a lot of it's about perspective. You know, you compare the note from that Chinese worker, and then you compare, say, somebody here in the U.S. that's still not doing great and they're having a hard time, but it's still a much, much better existence. You know, if you brought somebody over in that situation from China and said you can stay here for a while, you know, I think they'd be very thankful. I don't think they'd be too upset about it.
Yeah, it really is a matter of gratitude and hard work. And it is sad to see any poverty in the country at all. But it's also important to realize that human nature is not going to let people take in all this money and then somehow make it a good situation for themselves because of that.
Yeah, that's right from the New York Times. Ben Carson wants to make housing available, just not too comfy. So they
snarky.
They've got,
we've become accustomed to a lot of snarky headlines.
Yeah, it's taking a page out of the Onion. They kind of make their funny headline about it. But anyway, an interesting topic and interesting to look at that. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio live here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us there. All around the world, lots of listeners around the world, and appreciate you listening at that location, kpcg.fm. Also at thetrumpet.com, live link there, or you can use the TuneIn app. There's a few other places. And, of course, archives of programs are available at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com. Dwight Falk, Grant Hergen, Abraham Blondeau here today. And, Abraham, you've got some interesting headlines for us, interesting stories here. Before we get to yours on this new dinosaur that's been discovered, we always like dinosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
There's before we look all the way back then, they're projecting forward here. Stephen Hawking warns humans will have to leave Earth in another 100 years to survive. You know, it's always nice to pick something like 100 years when no one right now will be alive, probably. It's a pretty safe bet, because no one's going to call you on it when it's not right. In his new documentary, Expedition New Earth, it's part of BBC's science season, Tomorrow's World, Hawking will claim time is running out for Earth, and humans need to leave the planet to survive situations like climate change, asteroid strikes, epidemics, and overpopulation. So he is the bringer of bad tidings for the human race. Where does he want to go? There's no place out there to go.
Yeah, that's the big question. Is we've gone to the farthest reaches where it's practical for human space travel, and there's nothing even close or no place humans could go or would want to go. And also, I think he came out a few months ago saying that, and some other high-profile people have said that the biggest threat to Earth is robots. Huh. Like, if we create AI robots, that they'll eventually turn against us and destroy us. So there's that thought out there, too. They do have a relevant point, though, that mankind does have a lot of problems that we don't know the solution to.
Yeah.
But I think there's enough evidence to suggest that spaceflight probably isn't the answer.
give us a realistic option. That doesn't seem very practical. I mean, I know they're making some, they're trying to make some advancements, but you can't live up there very long. We're going to go to the moon?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's just no place to go. So, but it does show, like you say, that people are paying attention, and Stephen Hawking, obviously very smart guy, paying attention to things on this earth, and they realize there's a lot of problems and don't know how to solve it. Robot apocalypse, so I don't think that's probably one of them, one of the answers. But I never thought it would end like this. You know, you're getting destroyed by a robot. Going all the way back now, even further into time, National Geographic says a new bird-like dinosaur had modern feathers. Ahead of its time, very fashionable, apparently.
Yes. Yeah, this is a string of discoveries on from China, some fossils they found in China of dinosaurs that appear to have feathers, and they're always rendered as being very bird-like. This I thought was interesting because it does show how they view this history. And it is interesting because there are creatures from that time period that did have feathers or something that we interpret as feathers in the fossils, I think. I'm not sure if they could be anything else. But the name of this dinosaur is Jianyang Hualong Tengi.
Of course. So, rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, I'm going to shorten that to Tengi. but it lived about 125 million years ago during the Cretaceous period, they believe. And it was about 3 feet long and weighed as much as a chihuahua. So a really small creature. And the reason they're excited about this is that it has modern feathers, or the feathers they found on other fossils, they're very basic. They weren't asymmetrical. They didn't have barbs like birds do. So they couldn't fly. They were just feathers there maybe for insulation, that sort of thing. With this one, though, they found this little creature that had bird-like feathers. So they think this is a link in the evolutionary scale of how dinosaurs became birds.
Oh, yes.
So that's the narrative they have here. But this fossil was found in China, in Liaoning, China. There's a whole bunch of these feather-like creatures there they found in that area. And so I remember growing up as a kid, up until my middle teens, the dinosaurs were the dinosaurs everyone knew. They were scaly, looked like huge reptiles. They were huge reptiles. But after that point, they came across new discoveries, and they started making them look like birds. And to me, it ruined everything. But there is some evidence for it, that at least there were some creatures at that time period that did have feathers. Or at least that's what the fossils suggest. So,
And they carbon date these, I guess, to try to get their time period or whatever?
Yeah, they either carbon date them or they're found in the same area where there are other fossils that they can match to other ones around the world they know are from a long time ago. So when you hear Cretaceous, Jurassic, all these time periods, those are a little skeptical. Those haven't been proven to be true, that dinosaurs lived in different eons of time, because that's based off of a fossil record that has also been unproven. So,
right. They have this whole narrative, and everything kind of has to fit into that, or else you have to turn the whole thinking upside down, which nobody wants to do in the scientific community.
Yeah.
So those things are always debatable. But they did find a fossil, and it does have feathers.
Yeah, exactly.
we can.
Yeah, and that's what I thought was interesting, is that I think there's enough proof out there to show that the dinosaurs did live a long time ago, but the way we neatly organize it is probably, it's just the neat way for us to organize it. It's probably not the way it actually was in their ecosystems. But I think what's interesting about this is they did find a creature. It looks like a new creature. but it doesn't necessarily mean that it was with the dinosaurs or that it was a dinosaur, but that it's very old. And that it could be a part of a different time period, like with the mammoth and other type things. It could have been something that lived at that time, too. But in any event, it is a new creature, and it is kind of interesting because we're always finding these new ones. And we don't... I think what's interesting is you can read the article, and it talks mainly about how the lizards were learning how to fly until they developed these new feathers. But I think what's interesting is that we're finding these new creatures. We don't know where they fit exactly because they're new. We don't can't really explain them. But we still try to bend the new discovery to what we already understand. Maybe that's what we all do in a way based on our perspective. But I think if we were a little more honest about it, we don't know what these things are. They're some kind of bird-like creatures that are really old. But I think there's no relation to dinosaurs, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very interesting field that people get into with finding these creatures of the past, because they find them and then they're able to kind of just make up a nice story about it and based upon a few things they're looking at, and then people are like, oh, you know, and they believe it. And there's not too many. I don't know. There's too many fields of work where you can do that. You can just make something up, and there's no way to really totally prove it. They're just kind of going off of a few touchstones that they've all agreed upon. But again, even those are not, some cases are just inaccurate, or we just don't know. So it's an interesting field because it's a lot of guesswork.
Yeah, that's, I think, because I always loved paleontology and studying the dinosaurs when I was younger. But the more you get into it, the more you realize that it's not so much science as... imagination in some ways. And if you're to imagine history as a graph going up and down all the time, because history is always moving, and with a point at each time it moves, basically scientists, they're making assumptions back hundreds of millions of years based off of two points that are much closer to us. So they have two points in the graph, and then they're making up everything that's in between. And so we don't to make a certain assumptions based off of very, very limited data is, I mean, they can have theories, but there's some data points they don't count on, like from the Bible and other sources that could probably help them fill in the blanks on what happened and what these kind of animals are doing in an older type fossil.
Yeah. If they find a new dinosaur, I want it to be big.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that if they said, like, we've found, you know, we were able to recreate a dinosaur, kind of like Jurassic Park. Everyone's like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
And then they show you, and it's a small bird.
Is it a little chicken?
Like, that thing? That's a dinosaur? I think I saw one of those in my neighborhood. Like a roadrunner. But anyways, it's kind of interesting. They've got the rendering there in the article. It's National Geographic. New bird-like dinosaur had modern feathers. So they'll say what they will about that. Kind of interesting. Here's a quick note before we get into the historical section today. The next generation, they're already talking about the next generation. It's Generation Z, which is after the millennials.
Right.
So you're outdated, Abraham. There's new kids on the block. And they don't have an exact time period. I mean, it's not exact. It's somewhere late 90s, early 2000s, born in that area somewhere that you're considered Generation Z. And so they did a study. Google commissioned a study of Generation Z to find out what they thought was cool. Everybody wants to know what's cool. And so here is the scale from the most cool in Generation Z's opinion to the least cool. Most cool, YouTube, followed by Netflix, and then third was Google. It was Google's study. So I don't know if they would tell us opposite if it was true. Then in the middle there of the cool chart, you have Beats by Dre headphones. These are all products, of course, that they were pitching to people. And then as you start to slide into the least cool area, Axe body spray, Red Bull, and the least of the least cool, McDonald's. Which, if you look at McDonald's sales figures, I think that's somewhat accurate. People don't, at least the new generation, doesn't find it to be as cool as some used to.
Yeah, the golden archers are becoming obsolete. That's interesting. I think people aren't too surprised with the results. But at the same time, it is interesting how trends change. Because I remember growing up, a lot of those things were considered really cool. I remember when Axe body spray came out, kids would basically have a shower in it. They wouldn't use water. They would use Axe. And now it's frowned down upon as some kind of cheap gimmick almost or something like that. So it is just interesting to see how fickle humans are every generation.
Well, I think one thing does stand sort of the test of time as far as the way these trends go, and that is whatever was really considered quite cool, quite popular by the previous generation, the next generation will reject it.
Yeah.
Because they want to have their own thing. And so whatever used to be really on that edge of, oh, everybody just likes this or has this, that becomes a thing nobody wants and nobody likes. And those trends do change. And you see it particularly when you're younger, because that's kind of what the younger generation is what drives those trends. And I just remember even being in middle school and high school, and you'd see clothing trends change. And there's always a couple of kids caught in the middle, which way. There's always the Johnny come latelys. They jumped on it, but it was too late.
Yeah.
But that's always the way it goes. Whatever one generation loves, whether it be music, just pretty much anything, the next generation does not like it. And then give it a couple of years and a couple of generations, and it'll cycle back through again. That's always the way.
Yeah. I remember just watching, documentaries and movies, and they always point out that like the Beatles, when they came through, they really changed culture. But that their clothing and their hair was something that happened a few decades earlier. They're just bringing it back to where it was in a different package. But still, we always just recycle the same old things. And it's because people's tastes change, and we like changing things because we want to have the new things, not the other generation.
Yeah, and it's hard for the products or the celebrities or whatever that are really popular, and then they all of a sudden are very unpopular.
Yeah.
It's hard to deal with that, financially and other ways as well. For our historical note today, one of the things that's come up in the news recently has been President Trump's Civil War, quote unquote, revisionism. And we're going to look at today, is there merit to his comments, or is he completely wrong about the Civil War as the media claims? The comment that I saw printed where he said, had Andrew Jackson been a little later, you wouldn't have had the Civil War. He had a big heart. He was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. There's no reason for this. So those are the comments, and people are really jumping on him about it. What's your take on this?
Yeah, so He obviously, throughout his presidency, he's a big fan of Andrew Jackson as a president. And he made this comment, and almost every story I could find on it, he had CNN, other people have historians comment on it, and they were very heated in disagreeing with the president, saying he was ignorant, saying elementary school kids could answer his question for him, all those sorts of things.
I doubt that.
Yeah, so do I, because I teach them. And it's so it just basically made a big deal out of it. When in their the big points they're making is, well, Andrew Jackson died in before the Civil War even happened, so how could he have been there? And then the other thing saying is that Andrew Jackson was a slaveholder, so he would have supported slavery. He wouldn't have tried to end it like Abraham Lincoln did. So that's the big comments they're making. But I think if we actually look at what he's talking about, it actually makes sense. And this is not something that's original with him. This is actually a pretty commonly held view of many historians. And that is, when Andrew Jackson was president in the early, mid-1800s, so I think it was the 1830s, 1820s, 1830s, somewhere in there he was president. I don't remember off the top of my head. But during that time period, the country was becoming divided over a lot of major issues. And the Carolinas, I think it was North Carolina, they wanted to secede from the Union when Andrew Jackson was president.
Mm-hmm.
But what he did is he sent a warship down there, he sent the army down there, and he stopped them from seceding. So, and a lot of people give him credit for stopping the Civil War from happening decades earlier, because he... because that's what happened when Lincoln was elected. North Carolina seceded, and that's how everything started rolling towards the Civil War. So the Civil War, it was a decade-long buildup of all these different issues, very complex things. But what President Trump is saying is something that many historians believe in, is that Andrew Jackson prevented the Civil War because he was stopped North Carolina from seceding. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically what he's saying here, is if Andrew Jackson was alive in the 1870s, he would have stopped, or 1860s, he would have stopped the Civil War from happening because he would have used the same method. That's all the president is saying. And so it's something a lot of historians muse on. So it just, I think a lot of people are jumping on him and trying to criticize him for anything he says.
Yeah. Andrew Jackson, president from 1829 till 1837. And so, yeah, it's interesting because history always has a little bit of opinion in it, of course, as to what would happen, what did happen, what could happen. But the president is such a lightning rod for criticism that it's interesting to see historians, in some cases, jump on him and act like, you know, this is the most outlandish thing they've ever heard, when it's not that ridiculous. I mean, it's an opinion, but I think that just highlights how it's not really about history. It's about politics in terms of the backlash.
Yes.
And it's not a historical... They're not looking at it as a historical debate. They're just trying to pile on the politician they don't like. And that's the way it seems anyway.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's all about trying to... At least his opponents are trying to make him look ignorant of very important U.S. institutions. And Andrew Jackson himself is remembered more as a slaveholder than as a president or as a famous soldier. And so he himself is a center of controversy as well in the modern liberal education, where he is, most of the historians and only criticize President Trump, they criticize Andrew Jackson. So there's a very clear bend on this. And there's plenty of books I've read that where you could read their comment and then see where President Trump got this idea from. Mm-hmm. It's probably from a biography of Andrew Jackson, to be honest. That's probably where he got his thought from. So it's not that weird of a thought. And there's another headline associated with Mr. Trump. It's not as nothing he said, but on one of his golf courses, it's in North Virginia on the Potomac, right next to Maryland. And it's a golf course he's had there for a while. And on the golf course, there's a plaque between the 14th and 15th holes that's supposed to commemorate a Civil War battle that happened there. And it's been there for a while. But only yesterday, a headline came out saying it's a fake Civil War battle. It's part of Trump's history revisionism of the United States.
It's part of the grand plan to deceive everyone.
So this is what the plaque says. Many great American soldiers, both of the North and South, died at this spot. The casualties were so great that the water would turn red and thus became known as the River of Blood. It is my great honor to have preserved this important section of the Potomac River. So that's all it says. Immediately, I was reading they had some they couldn't get in a historian. They had some different people come on and they say it's no battle took place there. It's just... money-making scheme, or it's just part of his distorted view of American history. And so I went and did some investigation myself. And you can go on Google Earth and look at it, like around where the plaque is. It's on a section of Potomac that is right beside where the 1962 Maryland campaign happened, where and that's where the battles of Harper's Ferry and Antietam took place. So two big battles in the early Civil War. They're just down the river, and around that area, that's where the Union lines surrounding Washington were. So no major huge battle took place there, like Sharpsburg or Manassas or anything, but it's right in the area, the battle zone of where the Union and Confederate armies were marching through all of 1861, 1863. So there were troops always marching through that area of the country, and that's pretty close to where where Lee advanced, and there were Union troops there. So there seems like there was no major battle there, but there probably was some kind of skirmish there. I mean, There were so many skirmishes during the Civil War, thousands and thousands of them, that we don't commemorate every single one. We don't know where they all happened. And so I'm sure more information will come out about this in the future about specifically what's supposed to commemorate, maybe. But I'm sure something happened there. It's impossible to say, like, you know exactly where every battle took place, and it's impossible for it to have happened.
Well, and what's the big problem? I mean, it's being presented, I guess, from the media or whoever, like, everyone, you know, we're all just very specific about our history, and you better not even. I mean, most people don't know anything about a lot of that history.
Yeah.
But they're just not that interested. They haven't learned about it, whatever. And so to come out and make it out like, you know, we're all so so much into the nation's history, I don't think that's even a relevant point. And if he's trying to somehow manipulate people, and it's funny because you can't really play it both ways. I know the media is trying to, but you have a lot that come out and they're just ashamed of the United States and its history. And then on the other hand, now they come out and say, oh, you better get your history right. Well, which one is it? Are you ashamed of it all, or do you know it, or what do you? It's just two different, like, speaking out of both sides of their mouth, I think.
Yeah, well, it doesn't make sense to criticize this. It's something that was set up a long time ago. Why didn't they take issue of it then?
Yeah,
if it's historically inaccurate,
and how would it be a money making scheme?
Yeah,
why? No, that doesn't even make sense.
But yeah, it's just I think just making a crisis out of nothing. And also, if we are going to look at what different presidents have said about American history, President Trump is even close to being the biggest offender of it. I mean, the last president, President Obama, he said many, many different things, condemning the founding fathers, saying they're not as smart as we thought they were. Where was the outrage about that? Where yeah. he specifically called out something. It wasn't on a golf course or kind of a statement that other historians have said. It's his opinion that the Constitution is flawed and he needs to change it. I mean, that's revisionism, and there was no outcry about that.
Yep, playing favorites, I think. It's interesting to see the great historical outcries. And that's close to your heart because you're a history guy. So pretty interesting right up there. That's all the time we have for today on Trumper Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. Myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondo. Have a great rest of your Wednesday, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.